McDermott follows. She's an idiot. No, she's intelligent. I can't tell. Don't invite her, I say. After a pause, I hear Van Patten say, I sense weirdness starting. Well, if not Elizabeth, what about Sylvia Josephs? McDermott suggests. Nah, too old to fuck, Van Patten says. Oh, Christ, McDermott says. She's 23. 28, I correct. Really? A concerned McDermott asks after pausing. Yes, I say, really. McDermott's left saying, Oh. Shit, I just forgot, I say, slapping my hand to my forehead. I invited Jeanette. Now that is one babe I would not mind, inviting, Van Patten says lewdly. Why does a nice young babe like Jeanette put up with you? McDermott asks. Why does she put up with you, Bateman? I keep her in Kashmir. A great deal of Kashmir, I murmur, and then, I've got to call her and tell her not to come. Aren't you forgetting something? McDermott asks me. What? I'm lost in thought. Is, like, Evelyn still on the other line? Oh, shit, I exclaim. Hold on. Why am I even bothering with this? I hear McDermott ask himself, sighing. Bring Evelyn, Van Patten cries out. She's a babe, too. Tell her to meet us at Zeus Bar at 9:30. Okay, okay, I shout before clicking back to the other line. I do not appreciate this, Patrick, Evelyn is saying. How about meeting us at Zeus Bar at 9:30, I suggest. Can I bring Stash and Vanden? She asks coyly. Is she the one with a tattoo? I ask back coyly. No, she sighs, no tattoo. Bypass, bypass. Oh, Patrick, she whines. Look, you were lucky you were even invited, so just... My voice trails off. Silence, during which I don't feel bad. Come on, just meet us there, I say. I'm sorry. Oh, all right, she says, resigned. 9:30? I click back onto the other line, interrupting Van Patten and McDermott's conversation about whether it's proper or not to wear a blue suit as one would a navy blazer. Hello, I interrupt. Shut up. Does everyone have my undivided attention? Yes, 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 Van Patten sighs, bored. I am calling Cindy up to get Evelyn out of coming to dinner with us, I announce. Why in the hell did you invite Evelyn in the first place? One of them asks. We were joking, you idiot, the other adds. Good question, I say, stammering. Hold on. I dial Cindy's number after finding it in my Rolodex. She answers after screening the call. Hello, Patrick, she says. Cindy, I say, I need a favor. Hamlin's not coming to dinner with you guys, she says. He tried calling back, but your lines were all busy. Don't you guys have call waiting? Of course we have call waiting, I say. What do you think we are, barbarians? Hamlin's not coming, she says again, flatly. What's he doing instead? I ask, oiling his topsiders. He's going out with me, Mr. Bateman. But what about your, Bush benefit? I ask. Hamlin got it mixed up, she says. Pumpkin? I start. Yes? She asks. Pumpkin, you're dating an asshole, I say sweetly. Thanks, Patrick. That's nice. Pumpkin, I warn, you're dating the biggest dickweed in New York. You're telling me like I don't know this, she yawns. Pumpkin, you're dating a tumbling, tumbling dickweed. Do you know that Hamlin owns 6 television sets and 7 VCRs? Does he ever use that rowing machine I got him? I actually wonder. Unused, she says. Totally unused. Pumpkin, he's a dickweed. Will you stop calling me Pumpkin? She asks, annoyed. Listen, Cindy, if you had a choice to read WWD or... I stop, unsure of what I was going to say. Listen, is there anything going on tonight? I ask. Something not too boisterous? What do you want, Patrick? She sighs. I just want peace, love, friendship, understanding, I say dispassionately. What do you want? She repeats. Why don't the two of you come with us? We have other plans. Hamlin made the goddamn reservations, I cry, outraged. Well, you guys use them. Why don't you come? I ask lasciviously. Dump Dickweed off at Juanita's or something. I think I'm passing on dinner, she says. Apologize to the guys for me. But we're going to Cactus. I mean, Zeus Bar, I say, then confused, add, no, Cactus. Are you guys really going there? She asks. Why? Conventional wisdom has it that it is no longer the inn place to dine, she says. But Hamlin made the fucking reservation, I cry out. Did he make reservations there? She asks, bemused. Centuries ago, I shout. Listen, she says, I'm getting dressed. I'm not at all happy about this, I say. Don't worry, she says, and then hangs up. I get back on the other line. Bateman, I know this sounds like an impossibility, McDermott says, but the void is actually widening. I am not into Mexican, Van Patten states. But wait, we're not having Mexican, are we? I say. Am I confused? Aren't we going to Zeus Bar? No, moron, McDermott spits. We couldn't get into Zeus Bar. Cactus. Cactus at 9. But I don't want Mexican, Van Patten says. But you, Van Patten, made the reservation, McDermott hollers. I don't either, I say suddenly. Why Mexican? It's not Mexican, McDermott says, exasperated. It's something called Nouvelle Mexicana. Tapas or some other south of the border thing, something like that. Hold on, my call waiting. He clicks off, leaving Van Patten and myself on the line. Bateman, Van Patten sighs. My euphoria is quickly subsiding. What are you talking about? I'm actually trying to remember where I told Jeanette and Evelyn to meet us.
Let's change the reservation, he suggests.
I think about it, then suspiciously ask, where to?
1969,
he says, tempting me.
1969?
I would like to go there, I admit.
What should we do?
He asks. I think about it. Make a reservation, quick.
Okay.
For 3, 5, how many? 5 or 6, I guess.
Okay.
Hold. Just as he clicks off, McDermott gets back on. Where's Van Patten? He asks. He had to take a piss, I say. Why don't you want to go to Cactus?
Because I'm gripped by an existential panic, I lie.
You think that's a good enough reason, McDermott says. I do not.
Hello? Van Patten says, clicking back on. Bateman?
Well?
I ask. McDermott's here too.
Nope. No way, Jose.
Shit. What's going on? McDermott asks.
Well, guys, do we want margaritas?
Van Patten asks.
Or no margaritas?
I could go for a margarita, McDermott says.
Bateman? Van Patten asks.
I would like several bottles of beer, preferably un-Mexican, I say.
Oh, shit, McDermott says. Call waiting. Hold on.
He clicks off. If I am not mistaken, it is now 8:30. An hour later, we're still debating. We have canceled the reservation at Cactus, and maybe someone has remade it. Confused, I actually cancel a non-existent table at Zeus Bar. Jeanette has left her apartment and cannot be reached at home, and I have no idea which restaurant she's going to, nor do I remember which one I told Evelyn to meet us at. Van Patten, who has already had 2 large shots of Absolute, asks about Detective Kimball and what we talked about, and all I really remember is something like how people fall between cracks.
Did you talk to him?
I ask.
Yeah.
What did he say happened to Owen?
Vanished. Just vanished. Poof,
he says. I can hear him opening a refrigerator.
No incident, nothing. The authorities have nada.
Yeah, I say. I'm in heavy turmoil over it.
Well, Owen was...
I don't know, he says. I can hear a beer being opened.
What else did you tell him, Van Patten? I ask.
All the usual, he sighs. That he wore yellow and maroon ties. That he had lunch at 21. That in reality he was not an arbitrageur, which was what Thimble thought he was, but a merger maker. Only the usual. I can almost hear him shrug. What else? I ask. Let's see. That he didn't wear suspenders. A belt man. That he stopped doing cocaine, simpatico beer. You know, Bateman. He was a moron, I say, and now he's in London. Christ, he mutters. General competence is on the fucking decline.
McDermott clicks back on.
Okay, now, where to?
What time is it? Ben Patton asks.
9:30, both of us answer.
Wait, what happened in 1969? I ask Van Patten.
What's this about 1969?
McDermott doesn't have a clue.
I don't remember, I say.
Closed. No reservations,
Van Patten reminds me. Can we get back to 1500? I ask.
1500 is now closed, McDermott shouts. The kitchen is closed. The restaurant is closed. It's over. We have to go to Cactus.
Silence.
Hello? Hello? Are you guys there?
He hollers, losing it.
Bouncy as a beach ball, Van Patten says. I laugh. If you guys think this is funny,
McDermott warns.
Oh yeah, what?
What are you going to do? I ask.
Guys, it's just that I am apprehensive about failure in terms of securing a table before, like, well, midnight.
Are you sure about 1500? I ask. That seems really bizarre.
That suggestion is moot, McDermott screams. Why, you may ask? Because they are closed. Because they are closed, they have stopped taking reservations. Are you following this?
Hey, no sweat, babe, Van Patten says coolly. We'll go to Cactus.
We have a reservation there in 15 minutes ago,
McDermott says. But I canceled them, I thought, I say, taking another Xanax.
I remade them, McDermott says.
You are indispensable, I tell him in monotone.
I can be there by 10, McDermott says.
By the time I stop at my automated teller, I can be there by 10:15,
Van Patten says, slowly counting the minutes. Does anyone have any idea that Jeanette and Evelyn are meeting us at Zeus Bar, where we do not have a reservation? Has this passed through anyone's mind? I ask, doubting it.
But Zeus Bar is closed. And besides that, we canceled a reservation we didn't even have there,
McDermott says, trying to stay calm.
But I think I told Jeanette and Evelyn to meet us there, I say, bringing my fingers up to my mouth, horrified by this possibility.
After a pause, McDermott asks,
Do you want to get into trouble? Are you asking for it or something?
My call waiting, I say.
Oh my God, what time is it? My call waiting.
It's gotta be one of the girls,
Van Patten says gleefully.
Hold on, I croak.
Good luck,
I hear Van Patten say before I click off.
Hello?
I ask meekly.
You have reached the...
It's me,
Evelyn shouts, the noise in the background almost drowning her out.
Oh, hi, I say casually. What's going on?
Patrick, what are you doing at home?
Where are you?
I ask good-naturedly.
I am at Cactus, she hisses.
What are you doing there? I ask.
You said you'd meet me here, that is what, she says. I confirmed your reservations.
Oh, God, I'm sorry, I say. I forgot to tell you.
Forgot to tell me what?
To tell you that we aren't, I gulp, going there. I close my eyes.
Who in the hell is Jeanette?
She hisses calmly.
Well, aren't you guys having fun? I ask, ignoring her question.
No, we are not.
Why not? I ask. We'll be there. Soon.
Because this whole thing feels, gee, I don't know, inappropriate,
she screams.
Listen, I'll call you right back. I'm about to pretend to take the number down.
You won't be able to, Evelyn says, her voice tense and lowered.
Why not? The phone strike's over.
I joke, sort of. Because Jeanette is behind me and wants to use it, Evelyn says.
I pause for a very long time.
Patrick.
Evelyn. Let it slide. I'm leaving right now. We'll all be there shortly. I promise.
Oh, my God.
I click back to the other line. Guys, guys, someone fucked up. I fucked up. You fucked up. I don't know, I say in a total panic.
What's wrong?
One of them asks. Jeanette and Evelyn are at Cactus, I say.
Oh, boy.
Then Patton cracks up. You know, guys, it's not beyond my capacity to drive a lead pipe repeatedly into a girl's vagina, I tell Van Patten and McDermott, then add, after a silence I mistake for shock, finally on their parts an acute perception of my cruelty, but compassionately.
We all know about your lead pipe, Bateman, McDermott says. Stop bragging.
Is he, like, trying to tell us he has a big dick?
Van Patten asks Craig.
Gee, I'm not sure, McDermott says. Is that what you're trying to tell us, Bateman?
I pause before answering.
It's...
Well, no, not exactly. My call waiting buzzes.
Fine, I'm officially jealous,
McDermott wisecracks.
Now where? Christ, what time is it?
It doesn't really matter. My mind has already gone numb. I'm so hungry now that I'm eating oat bran cereal out of a box. My call waiting buzzes again.
Maybe we can get some drugs. Call Hamlin. Jesus, you can't walk into a bathroom in this city without coming out with a gram, so don't worry. Anyone hear about Bell South cellular deal?
Spuds McKenzie is on the Patty Winters show tomorrow. Girl. On a Wednesday night, another girl, who I meet at MK and I plan to torture and film. This one remains nameless to me, and she sits on the couch in the living room of my apartment. A bottle of champagne, Cristal, half-empty, sits on the glass table. I punch in tunes, numbers that light up the Wurlitzer. She finally asks,
"What's that smell in here?"
And I answer under my breath, "A dead rat." And then I'm opening the windows, the sliding glass door that leads out to the terrace, even though it's a chilly night, mid-autumn, and she's dressed scantily. But she has another glass of the Cristal, and it seems to warm her enough so that she is able to ask me what I do for a living. I tell her that I went to Harvard, then started working on Wall Street at Pierce & Pierce after I graduated from business school there, and when she asks, either confused or jokingly, "What's that?" I swallow and, with my back to her, straightening the new Annika, find the strength to force out, "A shoe store." I did a line of cocaine I found in my medicine cabinet when we first came back to my place, and the Cristal takes the edge off it, but only slightly. The Patty Winters show this morning was about a machine that lets people talk to the dead. This girl is wearing a wool Barathea jacket and skirt, a silk georgette blouse, agate and ivory earrings by Stephen Dweck, a silk jacquard torsolette vest, all from... where? Caravari, I'm guessing. In the bedroom, she's naked and oiled and sucking my dick, and I'm standing over her and then I'm slapping her in the face with it, grabbing her hair with my hand, calling her a fucking whore bitch, and this turns her on even more. And while lamely sucking my cock, she starts fingering her clit, and when she's asking me, "Do you like this?" while licking at the balls, I'm answering, "Yup, yup," and breathing hard. Her breasts are high and full and firm, both nipples very stiff, and while she's choking on my cock while I'm fucking her mouth roughly with it, I reach down and squeeze them. And then while I'm fucking her after ramming a dildo up her ass and keeping it there with a strap, I'm scratching at her tits until she warns me to stop. Earlier in the evening, I was having dinner with Jeanette at a new Northern Italian restaurant near Central Park on the Upper East Side that was very expensive. Earlier in the evening, I was wearing a suit tailored by Edward Sexton and thinking sadly about my family's house in Newport. Earlier in the night, after dropping Jeanette off, I stopped at MK for a fundraiser that had something to do with Dan Quayle, who even I don't like. At MK, the girl I'm fucking came on to me, hard, upstairs on a couch while I was waiting to play pool. "Oh, God," she's saying. Excited, I slap her, then lightly punch her in the mouth, then kiss it, biting her lips. Fear, dread, confusion overwhelm her. The strap breaks and the dildo slides out of her ass while she tries to push me off. I roll away and pretend to let her escape. Then, while she's gathering her clothes, muttering about what a crazy fucking bastard I am, I leap out at her, jackal-like, literally foaming at the mouth. She cries, apologizing, sobbing hysterically, begging for me not to hurt her, in tears covering her breasts now shamefully. But even her sobs fail to arouse me. I feel little gratification when I mace her, less when I knock her head against the wall 4 or 5 times until she loses consciousness, leaving a small stain, hair stuck to it. After she drops to the floor, I head for the bathroom and cut another line of the mediocre coke I scored at Nell's or O-Bar the other night. I can hear a phone ringing, an answering machine picking up the call. I'm bent low over a mirror, ignoring the message, not even bothering to screen it. Later, predictably, she's tied to the floor, naked on her back, both feet, both hands tied to makeshift posts that are connected to boards which are weighted down with metal. The hands are shot full of nails, and her legs are spread as wide as possible. A pillow props her ass up, and cheese, brie, has been smeared across her open cunt, some of it even pushed up into the vaginal cavity. She's barely gained consciousness, and when she sees me, standing over her naked, I can imagine that my virtual absence of humanity fills her with mind-bending horror. I've situated the body in front of the new Toshiba television set, and in the VCR is an old tape, and appearing on the screen is the last girl I filmed. I'm wearing a Joseph Aboud suit, a tie by Paul Stewart, shoes by J. Crew, a vest by someone Italian, and I'm kneeling on the floor beside a corpse, eating the girl's brain, gobbling it down, spreading gray poupon over hunks of the pink fleshy meat. "Can you see?" I ask the girl not on the television set. "Can you see this? Are you watching?" I whisper. I try using the power drill on her, forcing it into her mouth, but she's conscious enough, has strength to close her teeth, clamping them down, and even though the drill goes through the teeth quickly, it fails to interest me. And so I hold her head up, blood dribbling from her mouth, and make her watch the rest of the tape. And while she's looking at the girl on the screen bleed from almost every possible orifice, I'm hoping she realizes that this would have happened to her no matter what. That she would have ended up lying here on the floor in my apartment, hands nailed to posts, cheese and broken glass pushed up into her cunt, her head cracked and bleeding purple, no matter what other choice she might have made. That if she had gone to Nell's or Indochine or Mars or O-Bar instead of MK, if she had simply not taken the cab with me to the Upper West Side, that this all would have happened anyway. I would have found her. This is the way the Earth works. I decide not to bother with the camera tonight. I'm trying to ease one of the hollow plastic tubes from the dismantled habit trail system up into her vagina, forcing the vaginal lips around one end of it, and even with most of it greased with olive oil, it's not fitting in properly. During this, the jukebox plays Frankie Valli singing "The Worst That Could Happen," and I'm grimly lip-syncing to it while pushing the habit trail tube up into this bitch's cunt. I finally have to resort to pouring acid around the outside of the pussy so that the flesh can give way to the greased end of the habit trail, and soon enough it slides in easily. "I hope this hurts you," I say. The rat hurls itself against the glass cage as I move it from the kitchen into the living room. It refused to eat what was left of the other rat I had bought it to play with last week that now lies dead, rotting in a corner of the cage. For the last 5 days, I've purposefully starved it. I set the glass cage down next to the girl, and maybe because of the scent of the cheese, the rat seems to go insane, first running in circles, mewling, then trying to heave its body, weak with hunger, over the side of the cage. The rat doesn't need any prodding, and the bent coat hanger I was going to use remains untouched by my side, and with the girl still conscious,
The thing moves effortlessly on newfound energy, racing up the tube until half of its body disappears, and then, after a minute, its rat body shaking while it feeds, all of it vanishes, except for the tail. And I yank the habitrail tube out of the girl, trapping the rodent. Soon even the tail disappears. The noises the girl is making are, for the most part, incomprehensible. I can already tell that it's going to be a characteristically useless, senseless death, but then I'm used to the horror. It seems distilled. Even now it fails to upset or bother me. I'm not mourning. And to prove it to myself, after a minute or two of watching the rat move under her lower belly, making sure the girl is still conscious, shaking her head in pain, her eyes wide with terror and confusion, I use a chainsaw, and in a matter of seconds cut the girl in two with it. The whirring teeth go through skin and muscle and sinew and bone so fast that she stays alive long enough to watch me pull her legs away from her body. Her actual thighs, what's left of her mutilated vagina, and hold them up in front of me, spouting blood, like trophies almost. Her eyes stay open for a minute, desperate and unfocused, then close. And finally, before she dies, I force a knife uselessly up her nose until it slides out of the flesh on her forehead, and then I hack the bone off her chin. She has only half a mouth left, and I fuck it once, then twice, three times in all. Not caring whether she's still breathing or not, I gouge her eyes out, finally using my fingers. The rat emerges head first. Somehow it turned itself around inside the cavity, and it's stained with purple blood. I also notice where the chainsaw took off about half of its tail, and I feed it extra brie until I feel I have to stomp it to death, which I do. Later, the girl's femur and left jawbone lie in the oven, baking, and tufts of pubic hair fill a Steuben crystal ashtray, and when I light them, they burn very quickly. At another new restaurant. For a limited period of time, I'm capable of being halfway cheerful and outgoing, so I accept Evelyn's invitation to dinner during the first week of November at Luke, a new super-chic nouvelle Chinese restaurant that also serves, oddly enough, Creole cuisine. We have a good table. I reserved under Wintergreen's name, the simplest of triumphs. And I feel anchored, calm, even with Evelyn sitting across from me prattling on about a very large Fabergé egg she thought she saw at the Pierre, rolling around the lobby of its own accord, or something like that. The office Halloween party was at the Royalton last week, and I went as a mass murderer, complete with a sign painted on my back that read, "Mass Murderer," which was decidedly lighter than the sandwich board I had constructed earlier that day that read, "Driller Killer." And beneath those two words I had written in blood, "Yep, that's me." And the suit was also covered with blood, some of it fake, most of it real. In one fist I clenched a hank of Victoria Bell's hair, and pinned next to my boutonniere, a small white rose, was a finger bone I'd boiled the flesh off of. As elaborate as my costume was, Craig McDermott still managed to win first place in the competition. He came as Ivan Boesky, which I thought was unfair, since a lot of people thought I'd gone as Michael Milken last year. The Patty Winters show this morning was about home abortion kits. The first 5 minutes after being seated are fine. Then the drink I ordered touches the table, and I instinctively reach for it. But I find myself cringing every time Evelyn opens her mouth. I notice that Saul Steinberg is eating here tonight, but refuse to mention this to Evelyn. "A toast?" I suggest.
"Oh? To what?"
she murmurs uninterestedly, craning her neck, looking around the stark, dimly lit, very white room. "Freedom?" I ask tiredly. But she's not listening. Because some English guy wearing a 3-button wool houndstooth suit, a Tattersall wool vest, a spread-collar cotton Oxford shirt, suede shoes, and a silk tie, all by Garrick Anderson, whom Evelyn pointed out once after we'd had a fight at O-Bar and called gorgeous, and whom I had called a dwarf, walks over to our table, openly flirting with her, and it pisses me off to think that she feels I'm jealous about this guy, but I eventually get the last laugh when he asks if she still has the job at that art gallery on First Avenue, and Evelyn, clearly stressed, her face falling, answers no, corrects him, and after a few awkward words he moves on. She sniffs, opens her menu, immediately starts on about something else, without looking at me.
"What are all these t-shirts I've been seeing?" she asks. "All over the city? Have you seen them? Silky Ents equals death? Are people having problems with their conditioners or something? Am I missing something? What were we talking about?"
"No, that's absolutely wrong. It's science equals death," I sigh, closing my eyes. "Jesus, Evelyn, only you could confuse that and a hair product." I have no idea what the hell I'm saying, but I nod, waving to someone at the bar, an older man, his face covered in shadow, someone I only half know, actually, but he manages to raise his champagne glass my way and smile back, which is a relief.
"Who's that?"
I hear Evelyn asking. "He's a friend of mine," I say.
"I don't recognize him," she says. "P&P?
"Forget it," I sigh.
"Who is it, Patrick?"
she asks, more interested in my reluctance than in an actual name. "Why?" I ask back.
"Who is it?" she asks. "Tell me."
"A friend of mine," I say, teeth gritted.
"Who, Patrick?"
she asks, then squinting.
"Wasn't he at my Christmas party?"
"No, he was not," I say, my hands drumming the tabletop.
"Isn't it Michael J. Fox?"
she asks, still squinting.
"The actor?"
"Hardly," I say, then fed up.
"Oh, for Christ's sakes!
His name is George Levanter, and no, he didn't star in The Secret of My Success."
"Oh, how interesting."
Already Evelyn is back poring over the menu.
"Now, what were we talking about?"
Trying to remember, I ask, "Conditioners? Or some kind of conditioner?" I sigh. "I don't know. You were talking to the dwarf."
"Ian is not a midget, Patrick," she says.
"He is unusually short, Evelyn," I counter. "Are you sure he wasn't at your Christmas party?" And then, my voice lowered, "Serving hors d'oeuvres?"
"You cannot keep referring to Ian as a dwarf," she says, smoothing her napkin over her lap. "I will not stand for it,"
she whispers, not looking at me. I can't restrain myself from snickering.
"It isn't funny, Patrick," she says.
"You cut the conversation short," I point out.
"Did you expect me to be flattered?" she spits out bitterly.
"Listen, baby, I'm just trying to make that encounter seem as legitimate as possible, so don't, screw it up for yourself."
"Just stop it," she says, ignoring me.
"Oh, look, it's Robert Farrell."
After waving to him, she discreetly points him out to me, and sure enough, Bob Farrell, whom everyone likes, is sitting on the north side of the room at a window table, which secretly drives me mad.
"He's very good-looking,"
Evelyn confides admiringly. Only because she's noticed me contemplating the 20-year-old hard body he's sitting with. And to make sure I've registered this, she teasingly chirps,
"Hope I'm not making you jealous."
"He's handsome," I admit. "Stupid-looking, but handsome."
"Don't be nasty. He's very handsome," she says, and then suggests, "Why don't you get your hair styled that way?"
Before this comment, I was an automaton, only vaguely paying attention to Evelyn, but now I'm panicked, and I ask, "What's wrong with my hair?" In a matter of seconds, my rage quadruples. "What the hell is wrong with my hair?" I touch it lightly.
"Nothing," she says, noticing how upset I've gotten. "Just a suggestion."
And then, really noticing how flushed I've become,
"Your hair looks really, really great."
She tries to smile, but only succeeds in looking worried. A sip, half a glass of the J&B, calms me enough to say, looking over at Farrell, "Actually, I'm horrified by his paunch." Evelyn studies Farrell, too.
"Oh, he doesn't have a paunch."
"That's definitely a paunch," I say. "Look at it."
"That's just the way he's sitting," she says, exasperated. "Oh, you're..."
"It's a paunch, Evelyn," I stress.
"Oh, you're crazy," she waves me off. "A lunatic." Evelyn, the man is barely 30.
So what?
Everyone's not into weightlifting like you, she says, annoyed, looking back at the menu. I do not weightlift, I sigh.
Oh, go over and sock him in the nose then, you big bully, she says, brushing me off. I really don't care.
Don't tempt me, I warn her, then looking back at Farrell, I mutter, what a creep.
Oh my God, Patrick, you have no right to be so embittered, Evelyn says angrily, still staring into her menu. Your animosity is grounded on nothing. There must be something really the matter with you.
Look at his suit, I point out, unable to help myself. Look at what he's wearing.
Oh, so what, Patrick?
She turns a page, finds it has nothing on it, and turns back to the page she was previously studying. Hasn't it occurred to him that his suit might inspire loathing? I ask.
Patrick, you are being a lunatic, she says, shaking her head, now looking over the wine list.
God damn it, Evelyn, what do you mean being? I say. I fucking am one.
Must you be so militant about it? She asks.
I don't know. I shrug.
Anyway, I was going to tell you what happened to Melania and Taylor, and...
She notices something, and in the same sentence adds, sighing,
Stop looking at my chest, Patrick. Look at me, not my chest. Now anyway, Taylor Grassgreen and Melania were... You know Melania. She went to Sweetbriar. Her father owns all those banks in Dallas. And Taylor went to Cornell. Anyway, they were supposed to meet at the Cornell Club, and then they had a reservation at Mondrian at 7, and he was wearing...
She stops, retraces.
No, Lasigny. They were going to Lasigny, and Taylor was...
She stops again.
Oh, God, it was Mondrian. Mondrian at 7, and he was wearing a Piero Dimitri suit. Melania had been shopping. I think she'd been to Bergdorf's, though I'm not positive. But anyway, oh yes, it was Bergdorf's, because she was wearing the scarf at the office the other day. So anyway, she hadn't been to her aerobics class for something like 2 days, and they were mugged on one of...
Waiter? I call to someone passing by. Another drink? J&B? I point to the class, upset that I phrased it as a question rather than a command.
Don't you want to find out what happened?
Evelyn asks, displeased. With bated breath, I sigh, totally uninterested. I can hardly wait.
Anyway, the most amusing thing happened, she starts.
I am absorbing what you are saying to me, I'm thinking. I notice her lack of carnality, and for the first time it taunts me. Before, it was what attracted me to Evelyn. Now its absence upsets me, seems sinister, fills me with a nameless dread. At our last session, yesterday, in fact, the psychiatrist I've been seeing for the past 2 months asked, What method of contraception do you and Evelyn use? And I sighed before answering, my eyes fixed out the window on a skyscraper, then at the painting above the Terchon glass coffee table, a giant visual reproduction of a graphic equalizer by another artist, not Annika. Her job. When he asked about her preferred sexual act, I told him, completely serious, foreclosure. Dimly aware that if it weren't for the people in the restaurant, I would take the jade chopstick sitting on the table and push them deep into Evelyn's eyes and snap them in two. I nod, pretending to listen. But I've already phased out, and I don't do the chopsticks thing. Instead, I order a bottle of the Chassein Montrachet.
Isn't that amusing? Evelyn asks,
casually laughing along with her. The sounds coming out of my mouth loaded with scorn, I admit, riotous. I say it suddenly, blankly. My gaze traces the line of women at the bar. Are there any I'd like to fuck? Probably. The long-legged hard-body sipping a cur on the last stool? Perhaps. Evelyn is agonizing between the mâché raisin and gumbo salade, or the gratinized beet, hazelnut, baby greens, and endive salad. And I suddenly feel like I've been pumped full of clonopin, which is an anti-convulsive, but it wasn't doing any good. Christ, $20 for a fucking egg roll? I mutter, studying the menu.
It's a mooshu custard lightly grilled, she says.
It's a fucking egg roll, I protest. To which Evelyn replies,
You're so cultivated, Patrick.
No, I shrug, just reasonable.
I'm desperate for some beluga, she says. Honey?
No, I say.
Why not?
She asks, pouting. Because I don't want anything out of a can. Or that's Iranian, I sigh. She sniffs haughtily and looks back at the menu.
The Mufu jambalaya is really first rate,
I hear her say. The minutes tick by. We order. The meal arrives. Typically, the plate is massive white porcelain. Two pieces of blackened yellowtail sashimi with ginger lie in the middle, surrounded by tiny dots of wasabi, which is circled by a minuscule amount of hijiki, and on top of the plate sits one lone baby prawn. Another one, even smaller, lies curled on the bottom, which confuses me since I thought this was primarily a Chinese restaurant. I stare at the plate for a long time, and when I ask for some water, our waiter reappears with a pepper shaker instead and insists on hanging around our table, constantly asking us at 5-minute intervals if we'd like some pepper, perhaps? Or more pepper? And once the fool moves over to another booth, whose occupants I can see out of the corner of my eye, both cover their plates with their hands. I wave the maitre d' over and ask him, "Could you please tell the waiter with the pepper shaker to stop hovering over our table? We don't want pepper. We haven't ordered anything that needs pepper. No pepper. Tell him to get lost."
"Of course. My apologizes,"
the maitre d' humbly bows. Embarrassed, Evelyn asks,
"Must you be so overly polite?"
I put down my fork and shut my eyes. "Why are you constantly undermining my stability?" She breathes in.
"Let's just have a conversation, not an interrogation, okay?"
"About what?" I snarl.
"Listen," she says. "The Young Republican bash at the plot..."
She stops herself as if remembering something, then continues.
"At the Trump Plaza is next Thursday."
I want to tell her I can't make it, hoping to God she has other plans, even though 2 weeks ago, drunk and coked up at Mortimer's or O-Bar, I invited her, for Christ's sakes.
"Are we going?"
After a pause, "I guess," I say glumly. "For dessert, I've arranged something special. At a power breakfast at the 21 Club this morning with Craig McDermott, Alex Baxter, and Charles Kennedy, I stole a urinal cake from the men's room when the attendant wasn't looking. At home, I covered it with a cheap chocolate syrup, froze it, then placed it in an empty Godiva box, tying a silk bow around it, and now, in Luke, when I excuse myself to the restroom, I make my way instead to the kitchen, after I've stopped at the coat check to retrieve the package, and I ask our waiter to present this to the table, in the box, and to tell the lady seated there that Mr. Bateman called up earlier to order this especially for her. I even tell him while opening the box to put a flower on it. Whatever. Hand him a 50. He brings it over once a suitable amount of time has elapsed, after our plates have been removed, and I'm impressed by what a big deal he makes over it. He's even placed a silver dome over the box, and Evelyn coos with delight when he lifts it off, saying, "Voila!" And she makes a move for the spoon he's laid next to her water glass, that I make sure is empty, and turning to me, Evelyn says,
"Patrick, that's so sweet."
And I nod to the waiter, smiling, and wave him away when he tries to place a spoon on my side of the table.
"Aren't you having any?"
Evelyn asks, concerned. She hovers over the chocolate-dipped urinal cake anxiously, poised.
"I adore Godiva."
"I'm not hungry," I say. "Dinner was filling." She leans down, smelling the brown oval, and, catching a scent of something, probably disinfectant, asks me, now dismayed,
"Are you sure?"
"No, darling," I say. "I want you to eat it. There's not a lot there." She takes the first bite, chewing dutifully, immediately and obviously disgusted, then swallows. She shudders, then makes a grimace, but tries to smile as she takes another tentative bite. "How is it?" I ask, then urging, "Eat it. It's not poisoned or anything." Her face, twisted with displeasure, manages to blanch again as if she were gagging. "What?" I ask, grinning. "What is it?"
"It's so..."
Her face is now one long, agonized grimace mask, and shuddering, she coughs.
Minty.
But she tries to smile appreciatively, which becomes an impossibility. She reaches for my glass of water and gulps it down, desperate to rid her mouth of the taste. Then, noticing how worried I look, she tries to smile, this time apologetically.
It's just... she shudders again. It's just so minty.
To me, she looks like a big black ant. A big black ant in an original Christian LaCroix, eating a urinal cake. And I almost start laughing. But I also want to keep her at ease. I don't want her to get second thoughts about finishing the urinal cake. But she can't eat any more, and with only two bites taken, pretending to be full, she pushes the tainted plate away. And at this moment, I start feeling strange. Even though I marveled at her eating that thing, it also makes me sad, and suddenly I'm reminded that no matter how satisfying it was to see Evelyn eating something I and countless others had pissed on, in the end, the displeasure it caused her was at my expense. It's an anti-climax, a futile excuse to put up with her for 3 hours. My jaw begins to clench, relax, involuntarily. There is music playing somewhere, but I can't hear it. Evelyn asks the waiter, hoarsely, if perhaps he could get her some lifesavers from the Korean deli around the block. Then, very simply, dinner reaches its crisis point when Evelyn says,
"I want a firm commitment."
The evening has already deteriorated considerably, so this comment doesn't ruin anything or leave me unprepared. But the unreasonableness of our situation is choking me, and I push my water glass back toward Evelyn and ask the waiter to remove the half-eaten urinal cake. My endurance for tonight is shot the second the melting dessert is taken away. For the first time, I notice that she has been eyeing me for the last 2 years, not with adoration, but with something closer to greed. Someone finally brings her a water glass, along with a bottle of Evian I didn't hear her order. "I think, Evelyn, that..." I start, stall, start again. "That we've lost touch."
"Why? What's wrong?"
She's waving to a couple. Lawrence Montgomery and Gina Webster, I think. And from across the room, Gina holds up her hand, which has a bracelet on it. Evelyn nods approvingly.
My need to engage in homicidal behavior on a massive scale cannot be, corrected, I tell her, measuring each word carefully. But I have no other way to express my blocked needs.
I'm surprised at how emotional this admission makes me, and it wears me down. I feel lightheaded. As usual, Evelyn misses the essence of what I'm saying, and I wonder how long it will take to finally rid myself of her. "We need to talk," I say quietly. She puts her empty water glass down and stares at me.
"Patrick," she begins, "if you're going to start in again on why I should have breast implants, I'm leaving," she warns.
I consider this, then. "It's over, Evelyn. It's all over."
"Touchy, touchy," she says, motioning to the waiter for more water.
"I'm serious," I say quietly. "It is fucking over. Us. This is no joke." She looks back at me, and I think that maybe someone is actually comprehending what I'm trying to get through to them. But then she says,
"Let's just avoid the issue, all right? I'm sorry I said anything. Now are we having coffee?"
Again, she waves the waiter over.
"I'll have a decaf espresso," Evelyn says. "Patrick?"
"Port," I sigh. "Any kind of port."
"Would you like to see?" the waiter begins.
"Just the most expensive port," I cut him off. "And oh yeah, a dry beer."
"My, my,"
Evelyn murmurs after the waiter leaves. "Are you still seeing your shrink?" I ask.
"Patrick?"
she warns.
"Who?"
"Sorry," I sigh. "Your doctor."
"No."
She opens her handbag looking for something. "Why not?" I ask, concerned.
"I told you why," she says dismissively. "But I don't remember
I say, mimicking her. At the end of a session, he asked me if I could get him +3 into Nell's that night. She checks her mouth, the lips in the mirror of the compact. Why do you ask?
Because I think you need to see someone, I begin hesitantly, honestly. I think you are emotionally unstable.
You have a poster of Oliver North in your apartment, and you're calling me unstable? She asks, searching for something else in the handbag.
No. You are, Evelyn, I say.
Exaggerating. You're exaggerating, she says, rifling through the bag, not looking at me.
I sigh, but then begin gravely. I'm not going to push the issue, but...
How uncharacteristic of you, Patrick, she says.
Evelyn, this has got to end, I sigh, talking to my napkin. I'm 27. I don't want to be weighed down with a commitment.
Honey,
she asks. Don't call me that, I snap.
What, honey? She asks.
Yes, I snap again.
What do you want me to call you? She asks indignantly. CEO?
She stifles a giggle. Oh, Christ.
No, really, Patrick. What do you want me to call you?
King, I'm thinking. King, Evelyn. I want you to call me King. But I don't say this. Evelyn, I don't want you to call me anything. I don't think we should see each other anymore.
But your friends are my friends. My friends are your friends. I don't think it would work, she says, and then staring at a spot above my mouth. You have a tiny fleck on the top of your lip. Use your napkin.
Exasperated, I brush the fleck away. Listen, I know that your friends are my friends and vice versa. I've thought about that. After a pause, I say, breathing in, you can have them. Finally, she looks at me confused and murmurs,
you're really serious, aren't you?
Yes, I say, I am.
But what about us? What about the past? She asks blankly.
The past isn't real. It's just a dream, I say. Don't mention the past. She narrows her eyes with suspicion.
Do you have something against me, Patrick?
And then the hardness in her face changes instantaneously to expectation, maybe hope.
Evelyn, I sigh, I'm sorry. You're just not terribly important to me.
Without missing a beat, she demands,
well, who is? Who do you think is, Patrick? Who do you want?
After an angry pause, she asks,
Cher?
Cher? I ask back, confused.
Cher? What are you talking about?
Oh, forget it. I want it over. I need sex on a regular basis. I need to be distracted. In a matter of seconds, she becomes frantic, barely able to contain the rising hysteria that's surging through her body. I'm not enjoying it as much as I thought I would.
But what about the past? Our past? She asks again, uselessly.
Don't mention it, I tell her, leaning in.
Why not?
Because we never really shared one, I say, keeping my voice from rising. She calms herself down, and ignoring me, opening her handbag, again mutters,
pathological. Your behavior is pathological.
What does that mean? I ask, offended.
Abhorrent. You're pathological.
She finds a Laura Ashley pillbox and unsnaps it.
Pathological what?
I ask, trying to smile.
Forget it.
She takes a pill that I don't recognize and uses my water to swallow it.
I'm pathological? You're telling me that I'm pathological? I ask. We look at the world differently, Patrick, she sniffs.
Thank God, I say viciously.
You're inhuman, she says,
trying, I think, not to cry. I stall, attempting to defend myself,
in touch with humanity. No, no, no,
she shakes her head. I know my behavior is erratic sometimes, I say, fumbling. Suddenly, desperately, she takes my hand from across the table, pulling it closer to her.
What do you want me to do? What is it you want?
Oh, Evelyn, I groan, pulling my hand away, shocked that I've finally gotten through to her. She's crying.
What do you want me to do, Patrick? Tell me, please, she begs.
You should
Oh, God, I don't know. Wear erotic underwear? I say, guessing. Oh, Jesus, Evelyn, I don't know. Nothing. You can't do anything. Please, what can I do? She sobs quietly. Smile less often? Know more about cars? Say my name with less regularity? Is that what you want to hear? I ask. It won't change anything. You don't even drink beer, I mutter.
But you don't drink beer either.
That doesn't matter. Besides, I just ordered one, so there.
Oh, Patrick.
If you really want to do something for me, you can stop making a scene right now, I say, looking uncomfortably around the room.
Waiter,
she asks as soon as he sets down the decaf espresso, the port, and the dry beer.
I'll have a what?
She looks over at me tearfully, confused and panicked.
A Corona? Is that what you drink, Patrick? A Corona?
Oh, my God, give it up, please. Just excuse her, I tell the waiter. Then, as soon as he walks away, yes, a Corona. But we're in a fucking Chinese Cajun bistro, so...
Oh, God, Patrick,
she sobs, blowing her nose into the handkerchief I've tossed at her.
You're so lousy. You're inhuman.
No, I'm... I stall again.
You are not...
She stops, wiping her face, unable to finish. I'm not what? I ask, waiting, interested.
You are not...
She sniffs, looks down, her shoulders heaving.
All there. You... She chokes. Don't add up.
I do, too. I say, indignantly defending myself. I do, too, add up.
You're a ghoul,
she sobs. No, no, I say, confused, watching her. You're the ghoul.
Oh, God,
she moans, causing the table next to ours to look over, then away.
I can't believe this.
I'm leaving now, I say soothingly. I've assessed the situation, and I'm going.
Don't,
she says, trying to grab my hand. Don't go. I'm leaving, Evelyn.
Where are you going?
Suddenly, she looks remarkably composed. She's been careful not to let the tears, which actually I've just noticed are very few, affect her makeup.
Tell me, Patrick, where are you going?
I've placed a cigar on the table. She's too upset to even comment. I'm just leaving, I say simply.
But where?
She asks, more tears welling up.
Where are you going?
Everyone in the restaurant within a particular oral distance seems to be looking the other way.
Where are you going?
She asks again. I make no comment, lost in my own private maze, thinking about other things. Warrants, stock offerings, ESOPs, LBOs, IPOs, finances, refinances, debentures, converts, proxy statements, 8Ks, 10Qs, zero coupons, PIKs, GNPs, the IMF. Hot executive gadgets, billionaires, Kenkichi Nakajima, infinity, how fast a luxury car should go, bailouts, junk bonds, whether to cancel my subscription to The Economist, the Christmas Eve when I was 14 and had raped one of our maids, inclusivity, envying someone's life, whether someone could survive a fractured skull, waiting in airports, stifling a scream, credit cards and someone's passport, and a book of matches from Lacote Basque splattered with blood, surface, a Rolls is a Rolls is a Rolls. To Evelyn, our relationship is yellow and blue, but to me it's a gray place, most of it blacked out, bombed. Footage from the film in my head is endless shots of stone, and any language heard is utterly foreign, the sound flickering away over new images. Blood pouring from automated tellers, women giving birth through their assholes, embryos frozen or scrambled, which is it? Nuclear warheads, billions of dollars, the total destruction of the world. Someone gets beaten up, someone else dies, sometimes bloodlessly, more often mostly by rifle shot, assassinations, comas, life played out as a sitcom, a blank canvas that reconfigures itself into a soap opera. It's an isolation ward that serves only to expose my own severely impaired capacity to feel. I am at its center, out of season, and no one ever asks me for any identification. I suddenly imagine Evelyn's skeleton twisted and crumbling, and this fills me with glee. It takes a long time to answer her question, "Where are you going?" But after a sip of the port, then the dry beer, rousing myself, I tell her, at the same time wondering, "If I were an actual automaton, what difference would there really be?" Libya. And then, after a significant pause, Pago Pago. I meant to say Pago Pago. And then I add, Because of your outburst, I'm not paying for this meal. Tries to cook and eat girl. Dawn, sometime in November. Unable to sleep, writhing on my futon, still in a suit. My head feeling like someone has lit a bonfire on it, in it. A constant searing pain that keeps both eyes open, utterly helpless. There are no drugs, no food, no liquor that can appease the forcefulness of this greedy pain. All my muscles are stiff, all my nerves burning, on fire. I'm taking Somanex by the hour, since I've run out of Dalmane, but nothing really helps, and soon even the box of Somanex is empty. Things are lying in the corner of my bedroom. A pair of girl's shoes from Edward Susan Bennis Allen. A hand with the thumb and forefinger missing. The new issue of Vanity Fair, splashed with someone's blood. A cummerbund drenched with gore. And from the kitchen, wafting into the bedroom, is the fresh smell of blood cooking. And when I stumble up out of bed into the living room, the walls are breathing. The stench of decay smothers everything. I light a cigar, hoping the smoke will mask at least some of it. Her breasts have been chopped off, and they look blue and deflated. The nipples a disconcerting shade of brown. Surrounded by dried black blood, they lie, rather delicately, on a china plate I bought at the Pottery Barn on top of the Wurlitzer jukebox in the corner, though I don't remember doing this. I have also shaved all the skin and most of the muscle off her face so that it resembles a skull with a long, flowing mane of blonde hair falling from it, which is connected to a full, cold corpse. Its eyes are open, the actual eyeballs hanging out of their sockets by their stalks. Most of her chest is indistinguishable from her neck, which looks like ground-up meat. Her stomach resembles the eggplant and goat cheese lasagna at Il Marlborough, or some other kind of dog food. The dominant colors red and white and brown. A few of her intestines are smeared across one wall, and others are mashed up into balls that lie strewn across the glass-top coffee table like long blue snakes, mutant worms. The patches of skin left on her body are blue-gray, the color of tinfoil. Her vagina has discharged a brownish syrupy fluid that smells like a sick animal, as if that rat had been forced back up in there, had been digested or something. I spend the next 15 minutes beside myself, pulling out a bluish rope of intestine, most of it still connected to the body, and shoving it into my mouth, choking on it, and it feels moist in my mouth, and it's filled with some kind of paste, which smells bad. After an hour of digging, I detach her spinal cord and decide to Federal Express the thing without cleaning it, wrapped in tissue under a different name, to Leona Helmsley. I want to drink this girl's blood as if it were champagne, and I plunge my face deep into what's left of her stomach, scratching my chomping jaw on a broken rib. The huge new television set is on in one of the rooms, first blaring out the Patty Winters show, whose topic today is human dairies, then a game show, Wheel of Fortune, and the applause coming from the studio audience sounds like static each time a new letter is turned. I'm loosening the tie I'm still wearing with a blood-soaked hand, breathing in deeply. This is my reality. Everything outside of this is like some movie I once saw. In the kitchen, I try to make meatloaf out of the girl, but it becomes too frustrating a task, and instead I spend the afternoon smearing her meat all over the walls, chewing on strips of skin I ripped from her body. Then I rest by watching a tape of last week's new CBS sitcom, Murphy Brown. After that and a large glass of J&B, I'm back in the kitchen. The head in the microwave is now completely black and hairless, and I place it in a tin pot on the stove in an attempt to boil any remaining flesh I forgot to shave off. Heaving the rest of her body into a garbage bag, my muscles slathered with Bengay, easily handling the dead weight, I decide to use whatever is left of her for a sausage of some kind. A Richard Marx CD plays on the stereo. A bag from Zabar's, loaded with sourdough onion bagels and spices, sits on the kitchen table, while I grind bone and fat and flesh into patties. And though it does sporadically penetrate how unacceptable some of what I'm doing actually is, I just remind myself that this thing, this girl, this meat, is nothing, is shit. And along with a Xanax, which I am now taking half-hourly, this thought momentarily calms me, and then I'm humming, humming the theme to a show I watched often as a child. The Jetsons, The Banana Splits, Scooby-Doo, Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. I'm remembering the song, the melody, even the key it was sung in, but not the show. Was it Lidsville? Was it H.R. Puffin Stuff? These questions are punctuated by other questions, as diverse as, will I ever do time? And, did this girl have a trusting heart? The smell of meat and blood clouds up the condo until I don't notice it anymore. And later my macabre joy sours and I'm weeping for myself, unable to find solace in any of this, crying out, sobbing, I just want to be loved, cursing the earth and everything I have been taught, principles, distinctions, choices, morals, compromises, knowledge, unity, prayer. All of it was wrong, without any final purpose. All it came down to was die or adapt. I imagine my own vacant face, the disembodied voice coming from its mouth. These are terrible times. Maggots already writhe across the human sausage. The drool pouring from my lips dribbles over them, and still I can't tell if I'm cooking any of this correctly, because I'm crying too hard, and I have never really cooked anything before. Taking an Uzi to the gym. On a moonless night, in the starkness of the locker room at Exclusive, after working out for 2 hours, I'm feeling good. The gun in my locker is an Uzi, which cost me $700, and though I am also carrying a Ruger Mini, $469, in my Bottega Veneta briefcase, and it's favored by most hunters, I still don't like the way it looks. There's something more manly about an Uzi. Something dramatic about it that gets me excited, and sitting here, Walkman on my head, in a pair of $200 black Lycra bicycle shorts, a Valium just beginning to take effect, I stare into the darkness of the locker, tempted. The rape and subsequent murder last night of an NYU student behind the Gristides on University Place near her dorm, however inappropriate the timing, no matter how uncharacteristic the lapse, was highly satisfying, and though I'm unprepared by my change of heart, I'm in a reflective mood, and I place the gun, which is a symbol of order to me, back in the locker to be used at another time. I have videotapes to return, money to be taken out of an automated teller, a dinner reservation at 150 Wooster that was difficult to get. Chase, Manhattan. Tuesday night at Booley in No Man's Land. A fairly unremarkable marathon dinner, even after I tell the table, listen guys, my life is a living hell. They utterly ignore me, the group assembled, Richard Perry, Edward Lampert, John Constable, Craig McDermott, Jim Cramer, Lucas Tanner, continuing to argue about allocating assets, which stocks look best for the upcoming decade, hard bodies, real estate, gold, why long-term bonds are too risky now, the spread collar, portfolios, how to use power effectively. New ways to exercise. Stolichnaya Kristal. How best to impress very important people. Eternal vigilance. Life at its best. Here in Booley I cannot seem to control myself. Here in a room that contains a whole host of victims. Lately I can't help noticing them everywhere. In business meetings, nightclubs, restaurants, in passing taxis and in elevators. Online at automated tellers and on porno tapes. In David's cookies. And on CNN. Everywhere. All of them having one thing in common, they are prey, and during dinner I almost become unglued, plummeting into a state of near vertigo that forces me to excuse myself before dessert, at which point I use the restroom, do a line of cocaine, pick up my Giorgio Armani wool overcoat and the .357 Magnum barely concealed within it from the coat check, strap on a holster, and then I'm outside. But on the Patty Winters show this morning, there was an interview with a man who set his daughter on fire while she was giving birth. At dinner, we all had shark. In Tribeca, it's misty out. Sky on the verge of rain, the restaurants down here empty. After midnight, the streets remote, unreal, the only sign of human life, someone playing a saxophone on the corner of Duane Street, in the doorway of what used to be Duplex, which is now an abandoned bistro that closed last month. A young guy, bearded, white beret, playing a very beautiful but cliched saxophone solo. At his feet, an open umbrella with a dollar, damp and some change in it. Unable to resist, I move up to him, listening to the music, something from Les Miserables. He acknowledges my presence, nods, and while he closes his eyes, lifting the instrument up, leaning his head back during what I guess he thinks is a passionate moment. In one fluid motion, I take the .357 Magnum out of its holster and, not wanting to arouse anyone in the vicinity, I screw a silencer onto the gun. A cold autumn wind rushes up the street, engulfing us, and when the victim opens his eyes, spotting the gun, he stops playing. The tip of the saxophone still in his mouth, I pause too, then nod for him to go on, and tentatively he does. Then I raise the gun to his face and in mid-note pull the trigger. But the silencer doesn't work, and in the same instant a huge crimson ring appears behind his head. The booming sound of the gunshot deafens me. Stunned, his eyes still alive, he falls to his knees, then onto his saxophone. I pop the clip and replace it with a full one, then something bad happens. Because while doing this I failed to notice the squad car that was traveling behind me, doing what